You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Michael David. He's an artist and also a curator at the moment of Life on Mars Gallery. He was a musician and now is a full-time artist. And he was one of the youngest to win a Guggenheim Fellowship and numerous other awards. Michael, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about the show that you're curating now at the Life on Mars Gallery. I don't know a lot about that gallery, so if you want, you can speak a little bit to that. But the show that's happening now that you curated, what's happening there? I know there's a number of outsider artists in it, but maybe you can tell us more.
Sure. I started Life on Mars about 3 months ago for a number of reasons, which we can go into later. But the current show, Outside In, was an idea I had for a show for many years. I had moved to the South to teach at SCAD and recovering from illness and working on a project for the Center for Human and Civil Rights. And I was pretty damn sure I knew a lot of most of the history of contemporary art. I had, you know, showed at Janus when I was 26, Knoedler for 25 years when I was, 30, and, you know, thought I was pretty well acquainted with contemporary art. And when I went to the South, I thought there was really no rich history of visual arts. I thought it was all music and writing, which I knew there was a great history of. And I met Bill Arnett, who was the founder of Souls Grown Deep Foundation, and I learned about the work of Thornton Dial, which just blew me away. There were some commonalities in my own work to Thornton Dial, but, you know, I went to his warehouse in Atlanta, and it was like going to the south of France and coming across this warehouse of great Picassos. You know, besides Dial, there were many other great Southern vernacular artists, which is a term I prefer to outsider or folk, which I find, folk in particular, I find kind of a racist term. I start to wonder, how could this genius, you know, be so marginalized, even though he did have further looking at Dial, I did realize he had great, you know, press and museum history, but still not considering the same level of his peers like Kiefer or Basquiat or other artists or early Rauschenberg combines, which he's very much related to, and how could this happen? And the more I dug into this, I realized that there was this tremendous bias that falls along race and gender, which I don't think is intentionally based on race and gender, but isn't, you know, a evidence of the art world creating hierarchies to justify market positions. So I started to work on an exhibition of the pairing so-called outsider artists with insider artists without any labels that would have show their work together and to raise those questions without hitting people over the head with it. And I started also making a movie on Mr. Dial and Lonnie Holly and some other Southern vernacular artists. But a lot of the politics around those questions prevented me from making the movie and from doing the show at a larger venue, which I had tried to do. So when I was fortunate to open Life on Mars with the backing of the owners, it was a show that I decided that I had to do. And it couldn't be on the same scale as I originally planned, but my ability to access these beautiful early Dial works on paper, which were the only time he addressed the criticism of him being uneducated or less than, and those early Dial sculptures, some of the first sculptures he made since his fishing lures, gave me the basis for doing the show. Then it became much easier to compare to people like the master painter Joan Schneider, who shares a lot of similarities with Dials in the fact that she used mixed media. She'll use any means necessary to express a very personal, direct, emotional content that break the rules of modernism, and other artists that were in the show. So that was the basis for the show, and, you know, that's why this show came together. It's something I feel very, very strongly about. I also see a kind of recircling of postmodernism in outsider art and present work being done today. I mean, first generation of postmodernism, I would always believed that it was more inclusive because it allowed much greater voice for women, LGBT community, and African Americans in a worldview of art. What I didn't realize when I gave we had a big symposium about it was that I was fortunate in that my career, when postmodernism hit, I'm a painter, I wasn't really affected by the restrictiveness nature of postmodernism of what it became, and I realized a lot of painters really were kind of pissed about it because it excluded them. But what I'm seeing is a second generation of freedom of postmodernism, which is not based in a market-driven irony and is free of market concerns, which has a commonality with outsider art and the best of painting that I'm seeing again. So my being from New York and from the South, my being aware of what I'm seeing emerge in Bushwick right now, and my exposure to Southern vernacular art put me in a specific and a very, very unique position to put this show together.
Let's talk a little bit about how the, because it's fascinating how the gallery also came together. It's called Life on Mars in Bushwick. You're curating this, but how did it begin? You talked a little bit about there was support of the founder. Was it your idea, or was it a total collaboration? How did this gallery and this position that you have take form?
Well, when I got sick and my relationship ended with Knoedler after many years, I went down south to teach, and I worked for a while at Savannah College of Art and Design. And when that relationship ended, I started my own school, my own atelier, which has grown into now, I guess, a 25 to 30 artist atelier with postgraduate study that then works in cooperation with galleries that, you know, works in the way that an old atelier worked, except everybody's work is different, not looking like mine. And there was real desire for me to open a gallery down there, which I had thought about because it was a natural outgrowth of the work getting better and the support that I had received down there. And I still have a place in New York, and I go back and forth. I was going back and forth all the time. And my son, who just graduated college, had moved to Bushwick. And when I moved to Bushwick, when I started to see what had emerged in Bushwick, it was like, oh, my God, this is so familiar to what I remember in New York in the mid to late 70s when I emerged. And it really felt, you know, a tremendous amount of energy and felt very, very familiar to me. So I decided that I wanted to open a space devoted to painting, which I'm a champion of all kinds of painting. And I was fortunate enough to have people that were in Atlanta that had come to respect my vision and my and the work that I had done down there and said, let's go for it. So I decided to open this space. We built out a beautiful large space, and I was given complete artistic freedom and decision-making over the process without real concern for commercial restriction. And it really has become another creative endeavor for me, which I approach and curate as if I was making a painting. And I think that energy and that spirit of inclusiveness and openness, I mean, I don't have an office. We do symposiums. We welcome everybody. We look at work. We built in a short time. The Bushwick community has accepted us and embraced us, and that's because I think of the attitude that we're bringing there as well. And excuse me, Mullen. That's how the gallery got started.
And you said there were backers involved, so it wasn't just you involved putting up your own money. There was others who wanted to see this succeed as a commercial venture as well, or how did that happen?
Well, I don't think it was ever designed to be successful as a commercial endeavor. I think it was designed to really talk about painting, create a forum for painting, and to build a community. Because the thing that happened in Atlanta was that we did build this fantastic community around the atelier, which was never expected or intended. Sometimes when you do things for all the right reasons, they succeed. And so there was a desire to see if a similar thing could happen in New York, which is what we are in the middle of finding out, in the middle of trying to do.
Okay, so this gallery isn't intended to be, you know, a financial success or about the market in any sense. However, in New York, even Bushwick, you know, rent isn't like it was in the 70s. It still costs money to run this gallery. Your time, Thornton Dial, obviously is among a number of artists in that show that are prized artists, that are really collectible artists. So isn't that not part of the equation, or how does that not become part of the equation?
Well, it's become part of the equation. It was never intentionally that way. I mean, and we are selling work, and we sold work at prices that are, you know, I think, to a different market than the market that has been Bushwick in the past. But that was just never the intention. And I found out that in most of the things that I've been successful with in my life, that when I approach them from out of love, and I approach them without being really concerned with the commercial aspect of it, that's when they're successful in all ways. And I think that because we are showing fantastic art, and because we are showing it without compromise, we are attracting collectors. We are attracting business, and it's changing in that way. I think that also in working with great painters, many of them who, you know, I think have not been given the attention that they deserve for millions of reasons, I'm starting to feel more of a responsibility to actually, you know, be involved in the aspect of sales and things like that, which was never the original intention. And it's fascinating to me to see that. I mean, I don't see myself as an art dealer. I see myself as a curator. You know, I'm a painter first, and, you know, I'm making the best work of my life. So it's an interesting position for me to be in. But I think that we have been successful on all levels, and I think that it's growing in that way. And how the gallery morphs and changes, I'm not sure of yet. But the original intention of the gallery was without concern for commercial success and was not built along those lines. The fact that it's having some of that, I think, is based on the fact that we tried to approach it that way, which is kind of interesting.
Right. Let's move back a little bit. It's a very exciting gallery, and I hope all the listeners get a chance to visit the gallery, which there'll be links to in the text of this interview. But, Michael, let's go back to the early 70s, perhaps. I know you were born and raised in Brooklyn. Were your parents also artists or involved in the arts?
My mother was a painter. She's 86, and she's still painting her you-know-what off. And my grandfather was a painter in Russia who had to leave during World War One, and never painted here. He was a house painter. I do remember his shoes and his ability to mix color, but I always drew with them when I was young, and I always was encouraged to be an artist. I had won some stuff when I was seven or eight in the cities and drawing contests, and so I was always self-identified and supported as an artist from a very, very young age. And it was obvious that when I was not going to be good enough to be the center fielder for the New York Yankees, that I was going to be a painter. It was one of those two. And so the answer is that I was raised in a family with awareness of painting and supported that way. And one of the reasons why I had so much early success was because I was encouraged and never like, oh, what are you really going to do for a living? What are you going to do? You should be a lawyer or an accountant. That was never, I was born out of painters, and I was allowed to become a painter with the support of my family at a very early age.
And when did you decide? I know it seems an odd question that you weren't going to be a center fielder for the
I think it was decided for. I think it was decided for me at a fairly young age. I wasn't fast enough or good enough. But those are my two loves. Sports and art were always my two loves.
And music also must have come into play at that point, because in the 70s you formed a band. How did music enter the equation?
Well, I was in New York. You know, I went to music school in upstate New York in Fredonia for a year, and there I met Richie Stotts, who was my roommate and my best friend, and he formed the Plasmatics, and we had bands that became the Plasmatics. Me and Richie and the drummer Roy Stewart had a band called Numbers that were the basis for the Plasmatics, and we played everywhere. And it was New York in 1975 and 76. First generation of CBGBs, played at Max's Kansas City, played with Cheetah Chrome and Jerry Nolan and all of the first generation New York great, you know, punk musicians. And if you were young, you were open, and you were in New York in 76 and 77, it was, you know, a fantastic time. And I played in bands and had an amazing time. And I think in some ways, my imprint as a painter was formed by the intense experience of playing on stage with these people and the excitement, and that I could never look at painting without wanting to have the same kind of impact and physicality and immediacy that I saw and felt in that music. And I do think that there is a relationship to first-generation Ab-X and to first-generation punk. I think that they were both something that came out of a time of struggle and poverty and cross-mingling in New York when things were wide open and things could develop. And one thing that I see in Bushwick that reminds me of that, very different in many ways, is that because the art market slowed for entry-level artists, and because there was a remission in real estate for 3 or 4 years, and people had moved to Bushwick, work started to develop in a way that was free of market concerns, and more slowly, because painting does take a little while to develop, as opposed to when things were all crazed in the 90s and the turn of the century. I think one of the essential differences, and one of the things that I'm really concerned about, and I don't really know how to help out here, is that when I came up, you could always move to a further or worse neighborhood and get a big studio cheap. I don't see any more big studios cheap. I go into studios now, and I'm constantly making studio visits, and I see the same smell. I see work that reminds me of that. I see people who are putting their lives on the line to paint, but they're painting in one room that's 160 square feet. And I don't know how, and even now that's becoming too expensive. So I think that there is a real crisis of affordable, decent studio space for artists in New York, way more than what I came up with in the 70s and, in the 80s. My first loft was 4,000 square feet on Bond Street for $900 a month. And it allowed us to have, it allowed me to paint, it allowed me, Richie, to form bands, it allowed us to put on shows where we built up our band over years and create this following, among other things that we did. So
let's go back to that scene. Sorry to interrupt a little bit, because that's further ahead, but it's in the 70s, you're playing around, it sounds like a very exciting time to play music, but at this exact same time you're also painting, and now it's the late 70s, and somehow you're continuing to paint, I would think, in obscurity to some degree, because you must be spending a lot of time playing music. How is it that suddenly you stopped playing music and started painting?
I was never in obscurity. I mean, the thing is that, I was 22 when I started the show. I had my first show at Sydney Janus when I was 25. They were, I was showing when I was in college. I mean, it was never, I never paint, if my painting had suffered for any reason, it's because I never painted a day in obscurity in my life, actually, to tell you the truth. So I was playing in the bands, and I was painting, and I was repped by this guy named David Boyce, who at that point was representing me and Kerry Winters and Joseph Marioni and Phil Sims before we had gotten galleries, and still playing all the time. And in those days, I was young and doing a lot of things that necessarily I shouldn't do. So I was working around the clock. That was the way everybody worked. at those days doing both. In fact, I had a part-time job watering plants at Bloomingdale's and Laura Ashley in the Whitley Museum in the morning that I would get paid for a 40-hour week, and I would go in at 6 o'clock in the morning and run right through and kill all the plants and be done by 9 o'clock, and then go home and paint and then go out and play gigs. And David Boyce was was working at Sidney Janis and was curating a show, which is 1980, called Seven Young Americans, and he picked me to be in that show, and which was also Carol Deal and Joseph Marioni and me and Charles Clough and a number of people. And at that point, the paintings I put in that show were very successful, and Edward Albee bought one and started to support me and my work, and the thing took off, and that was it. At the same time, the Numbers were starting. That was the name of the band that me, Richie, and Roy Stewart had. The Numbers had become pretty successful, and Rod Swenson, who started the Plasmatics, was looking for a band to back them up. And he wasn't really that interested in me being in the band, and I would have had to really kind of have a very marginal position in that band to stay with it. And Richie wanted to play with the band, and I said, well, okay, then that's it. I'm going to, you know, just paint. And I did continue to play for a while. I played with Peter Gordon and had the pleasure of playing for Philip Glass and played with Cheetah Chrome and Jerry Nolan and the music industry Casualties, which was the band they formed with Sid Vicious right before he died, and played in that band and played, you know, was kind of a bass player that they would get to play in bands to replace people. But over the next couple of years, as my relationship with Janis then grew into a relationship with Nodler and I started to show every year, then my playing on stage and my playing professionally stopped.
You said you also had somebody who was representing you. Can you explain that relationship a little bit? Is that in terms of your artwork that helps you get into galleries, or what did that mean?
David Boyce had worked for Sidney Janis. He was working for Sidney Janis, and he was starting to represent. It was a similar time. There were all these wonderful painters that had not quite gotten galleries, and it was me and Marioni and Phil Sims and Terry Winters, and he would represent us, trying to get us into shows and expose us to collections. And, you know, I was just right out of college when that happened. In fact, I had my first show while I was still in college.
He was getting you into shows. I'm sorry to interrupt. He was trying to get you into shows in Sidney Janis or in other galleries and shows as well?
As well. But when he was given the opportunity to curate a show, you know, to bring these artists to Sidney Janis, I was the artist, you know, that Carol Janis, who was Sidney's son, was the person that was responsible for me coming to Sidney Janis at that point. But he was, you know, working with he was trying to put us in different collections, David Boyce. And actually, my full name on the record is Michael David Singer. And I had become Michael David for a number of reasons. My first show when I was in college was at the Soho Center for the Visual Artists. And there was another very famous sculptor at the time named Michael Singer, who had like limos lined up for the show, and when they came there, it wasn't for me, and I was kind of crestfallen. Also, when I was playing all those punk bands, swastikas were all the vogue. So in some ways, Michael David was also kind of my owning my religion or my culture in the face of all those people. The third thing was that, you know, when David Boyce started to represent me, he said you couldn't be confused with Michael Singer anymore. And at that point I was, you know, young and handsome and looked like kind of like the Michelangelo David. So he said, you're Michael David. So I became Michael David. And then when I went to Janis, they said, oh, you should go back to Michael David Singer. It sounds like a hairdresser. And I really couldn't do that. I had so much support from David Boyce and the gay community in general, and had gotten as far as Michael David, and I decided to stay Michael David. But my full name is Michael David Singer, but that was
okay,
really
so
related.
That's clear and interesting. So this is now it's the 80s. You're in Sidney Janis.
80-81, yeah, yeah.
881. So and you're having solo shows. I imagine that's the first time that you're achieving, or not the first time, but that's financially there's success there probably that you hadn't known before. That's the beginning of the art market in a lot of ways, and Basquiat and people beginning to make money. Was that also the case for you at Sydney Janus?
Well, it was to some extent, but where that really happened was at Knoedler, when I went to Knoedler, and that was I come from a lower middle class family, so I had no experience with money, and yes, there was a point where I was making a tremendous amount of money painting every year at a very, very early age, and lived in a way that was beyond my means, and lived in a way that was lived very well. Yes, so there was this whole ability to try to understand what all of that meant. You know, selling paintings. And, you know, those days, if you opened a show and it wasn't sold out before you opened it, something was wrong. You know, if you didn't have a waiting list, then something was wrong. And, that was artificial, and that was really based in a kind of market that was just, you know, brand new to young artists and to the contemporary art world. I was among the first generation of that did experience that kind of rush.
And that must have been very exciting. I mean, that's as much as it has a lot of different nuances to it, that sounds like a tremendously exciting time, you know, to start a whole new life in a sense. I mean, I know you always were a painter, but still to move successfully from music into, you know, what could be called kind of super success as an artist and people who are embracing what you're doing must have been enormously exciting, and especially being with Knoedler, which is, you know, a very important gallery and one that has a huge collector base, I would imagine, at that time.
Well, it was amazing. I mean, when I was there, it was Stella and Motherwell, Hodgson and Diebenkorn, and, you know, not even to mention the great secondary works that were there. I was really there at one of the high points of the gallery when, you know, one must be a Howard Hodgkin show, the next might be a Richard Diebenkorn Ocean Park work on paper show. It was a little intimidating, to tell you the truth. I mean, you know, I think that I'm not sure that my going from zero to blue chip was necessarily the best thing for me in my work, because my work wasn't blue chip. And I think that, you know, I isolated myself in many ways from my own community and from my own age group. I didn't stay downtown. I didn't show with Sonnabed. I didn't show with Boone. I didn't show with those people. I went to Janus and Nola. And I'm not necessarily sure it was the best thing for me or for my work. But, you know, I was, you know, 27, 28, 29, and 30. I had no real experience with that kind of success. And as far as music, I wouldn't say we were successful. I would say that we had a hell of a lot of fun, and people were looking at us, but, you know, we were, you know, certainly the level of success that I had musically nowhere was in the same ballpark as what I had as a painter. And I was, you know, much better painter than I was a musician. I mean, when you play punk rock bass, basically, you know, in early punk, a chimp could play bass. So if you look good and you can scream, you can play bass in punk.
So there's a certain kind of glory to that, you know. It's kind of
yes,
wonderful.
There was. It was a tremendously exciting time. And certainly, you know, working, you know, having the work of it Knoedler was just mind blowing. I don't think I really even understood what that meant or what that was at the time.
So now I know you were working with Encaustic, and can you tell us a little bit about what happened then in 2000, 2001, when you encountered difficulty and sickness and had to stop for a time?
Well, I was in the first fine arts graduating class at Parsons, and at that point there were a lot of painters that were teaching at Rivers and Alain de Kooning, who was the one teacher I had who I really loved and really connected with. And Parsons was not really about teaching art, but because you were in New York and because you got to be around artists like that, you got to learn what it was to be an artist and what that life was. And I was kind of making these bad second-rate abstract paintings that were kind of based on de Kooning and Klein, Slavs of the New York School. And I was talking to Elaine about it, and she mentioned to me that you have to, all great painters change and modify their materials when they have their own real expression. And I remember watching Painter's Painters, seeing de Kooning talking about how he would boil his brushes and load his paint up with oils because he wanted his drawing to come out so specifically and so beautifully in his painting. And I was exposed to a materials class by Arthur Graham, who I think now has become a very prominent paint manufacturer. I think it's either Blick or something like that. I don't know which one it is.
And what year is this that we're talking about? I'm sorry to interrupt. What year is this?
1975. And I started to work with Encaustic. And once I worked with Encaustic, that was it. Because it really mirrored my own personality. I could work directly, fast, physically. I could subtract. I could embed. I could make 300 pounds. I could burn things down. I could marry recognizable imagery with that material. And it was a perfect metaphor for my own personality and for my own process as a painter. And that's when people started to pay attention to me. And at that point, the painter who was really the painter of the moment, and he's had quite a long moment after that, was Bryce Martin. He was painting with Encaustic, or a hot wax technique, which is really not Encaustic, but a stepchild of Encaustic. So, I started to riff off of Martin, and also I was in love with Johns, and certainly the early symbol paintings, which is what I broke through with, were really a synthesis of Martin, Johns, and early Stella. And so I started making these paintings that were these huge paintings, and I saw that on the cover of Art Forum, I think it was Bryce Martin, had a big painting, and he had 2x4s underneath it to keep a painting on the floor and work at it. So naturally, I imitated that. And what started to happen was that the paintings that I would make, the wax would drip onto the 2x4s on the floor. And the 2x4s on the floor became more interesting than what I was painting on. So then I started to line those up in the wall, and I would make associations based on the color, sexuality, or race, or whatever. And because I was a terrible carpenter, the only thing I could build was a right angle. And from a right angle, it became a cross. And once I made the cross, that's when all hell broke loose, because it connected in a way that allowed me to connect back to political issues and to punk. Because from crosses, I made swastikas and I made Jewish stars. And the ability for me to embed meaning into abstract expressionist handling through the use of encaustic, and therefore the use of a kind of embedded meaning that could then be expressed through a shaped format, is why the thing took off. And I kept on experimenting with encaustic for years and years and years. At the height of my work, at the height of my career with Nodler, I was painting for 4 or 5 shows, and I had moved to a new studio where I had changed my ability to burn encaustic. And I had worked on an electric stove before, which limited me to 180 degrees. I moved to a gas stove because at that point, you know, all I wanted to do was bigger, better, faster, more. And also, when you make encaustic, you're supposed to sift and put the more crystal into it as a binder, which was way too slow for me. At this point in my life, I was, you know, making a tremendous amount of money painting and a lot of things going on. And I started to paint for these shows, and I was heating the wax past 220 degrees, which is the safety zone. And instead of melting the Damar beforehand, I was pouring liquid Damar into it. And the first thing that happened was that I lost my sense of smell. So people would come in the studio and they'd say, "This place smells horrible. What are you doing?" And I'd be like, "Oh, get out of here. You know, you don't know what you're talking about." What I did not know is that when you heat encaustic past 220 and you put the solvents into it, it breaks down encaustic into its elements and off gases. And one of them is acrolein, which is the active agent in mustard gas. So over the next 6 months, I, you know, burned out 70% of my peripheral nervous system, which left me paralyzed from the waist down and eventually paralyzed from the knees down. To this day, I still have very limited mobility from my knees down. And that's how I got sick. And that, you know, really stopped momentum and my ability to paint for a while, was a major contributing factor to my end of my relationship with Knoedler and to my moving down south part-time to teach at SCAD, which is how the gallery came into being and how we get back to the present day of where I got, how I ended
right.
up.
Right, I mean, that sounds
how
sounds
I ended up there on the phone with. No,
right.
It wasn't. In some ways, I think the fact that I was really a great athlete when I was younger, the fact that I was, you know, in really good shape at the time, the fact that I did have means, I was like, no, I'm gonna take care of this. I mean, I did have a year or two where I was like, you know, really kind of lost and made some mistakes, some very bad mistakes. But in the end, it's, you know, I had such a rush from 22 to, you know, 45, where there wasn't a day in my life I didn't do anything that I wanted to without thinking about that, that I wasn't always the most mindful or nicest person. I was always sweet, and I think I always had a generous heart, but I was really angry and really aggressive and didn't listen. I think that while, you know, I would rather have not learned this lesson by being, by getting sick or by my relationship with Knoedler ending, it made me a much more mindful, compassionate human being. And I gained a lot of things from it as well. You know, I'm happier and more centered, making the best work of my life, involved with more people and more friends and community than I've ever been before. And so while it was hard, there were tremendous things that I gained from that. I really did.
And so that does bring us up to the present day, and that's you know, quite an experience that you've been through, and quite a series of life events. You have this gallery now. You're curating at this gallery. You're painting again. How is your career as a painter come back? What's happening now? You said you're painting a lot. Are you also exhibiting and showing those works? Have more relationships with galleries begun again, or how is that working?
Well, for years, one of the reasons why I went to Atlanta was that, you know, Knoedler had many galleries that worked with them in New York. Meredith Long, Marty Margolis, Ronnie Greenberg, Bill Lowe, and I worked with all of them. And the one relationship that endured was the one with Bill Lowe. And, you know, I show with him, you know, on a yearly basis, and you know, I just have a great show up there now, and we're very fortunate that we do very, very well still with the paintings. I have not shown with New York for a while, and my paintings took me a long time. I have a painting in Bill Lowe right now that took me 7 years to do and weighs, you know, 340 pounds. So, but I am fortunate in my relationship with him that we are, you know, successful and place all those paintings. And that's, you know, what goes on with my painting right now. I don't really produce very many paintings because they do take me so long and because they are physically challenging for me to do. Also, within my relationship with Bill Lowe, I'm fortunate that many of the artists I've worked with in the atelier now show with him, and, you know, I have a very open and, permeable relationship with him in terms of access to that space. And it's a huge space and a beautiful space. I'm hoping that, you know, in the spring that I'll be able to organize bringing down some Brooklyn artists and Life on Mars, you know, Life on Mars down to Atlanta and share some of that success with the artists I see up in Bushwick.
So you're represented by Bill Lowe in Atlanta at this point?
Yeah, and Meredith Long in Houston. Yeah.
Michael, it's really been wonderful talking to you today, and I hope more people will come and see your show at Life on Mars. Is there anything you want to leave with us today? The listeners are from around the world, different people, all different ages, artists. About art, the process that you're working on now, or just the art studio process in general?
I think that, I think the things that I've learned I believe more in desire than talent. I believe that if you do what you love, and if you are honest with yourself and others, you have a chance to be happy and find success on your own terms. I think that the practice of painting for me has been kind of a secular spirituality that I have been deeper into at sometimes and not as deep in other times, like any other spirituality. And I think that if you love painting and if you are a painter, there is no choice to do anything else. I think that, and I believe these things because I've seen them, you know, evidence change in truth. I want to thank the Bushwick community for supporting me so well. I mean, we had 400 people at that last opening, and the energy level was just beautiful. And we're connecting different generations of people there. We're doing an Arnold Meshi show in April. He's 90, and people are thrilled to see him. To see the reception that Joan Schneider got from artists that have admired her work for years was very moving. And I think that it's a fantastic life. Those are the only things that I can really say that I've learned that I know are really true.
Michael, thanks so much for talking with us today.
I appreciated the time, and I appreciated your questions, and thank you for listening to me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.